Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, your weekly opportunity to listen in as my guest authors go deeper into the backstory of their literary work, with, of course, a specific focus on how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader or listener at a time. As always, if you have to leave the show early, this and previous shows are always available on demand at www.voiceofvashon.org. And now, let me welcome this show's guest author, Harold Ta. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, March.
Thank you for coming over to the island.
Oh, that's great to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind doing interviews on the phone. It's great with people who are, you know, on the other side of the planet. But it's always a treat to have someone in the studio.
It's great to actually be on the island and to do this. So thank you.
You have a little bit of history with the island or not much?
Well, I do have a history with the island. Actually, we have a very close friend who lives here. And our twin children, who are now 6 years old, spent two summers over here on Vashon Island. So we're really quite familiar with the island and come over and visit a lot.
That was a sense I had. And you're in West Seattle right now, pretty much near the Fauntleroy Ferry.
Right. We're about two blocks away from the ferry terminal.
Right. Excellent, excellent. Okay, so we're talking to a local. And now I'm going to go ahead and explain how we met a bit. 2 years ago, you came and presented to the EDGE Professional Development Class of 2013. That's a great program created by Artist Trust, which is a Washington State. I don't know. How would they describe themselves? Basically, artist support network in a way.
Right. They're just trying to support artists at the source. So they try to support individual artists as opposed to organizations or anything like that. They try to fund that person's work.
Right. And they work with both visual and literary artists. And there was a gentleman who was talking with us about publishing, contract law, legalities and whatnot, and also the changes with digital publishing over the past decade. And at the time, you came to speak about your experiences publishing your novel with Amazon as your publisher.
That's right, as Amazon as their traditional publishing arm. So before they were simply a platform for self-publishing,
right.
And then they decided they wanted to become a publisher themselves. So they offered me a contract about a year and a half into starting up as a traditional publisher. At that time, they were a little bit more of a boutique publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, they've developed, they opened a New York office, they opened a lot of different imprints, but at that time, there was just simply two imprints, and one imprint was for works in translation, and the other imprint was to try to find something that they thought, if they put their marketing might behind, might gain a wider audience.
Right. So, very interesting. Now, Amazon, of course, is quite local as well.
Yes, and which is unusual. For most people, it's not a local company, but for us, it actually is, which is bizarre.
Yeah, no, I have the same exact feeling. It's sort of like, I don't know, it thrives on its ability to provide things to people from far away. And so you have this mindset of this is that far away thing. And then you're like, oh, and there's the office right over there, you know, and your friends could like be commuting there every day by bike.
That's right. I think it's unusual in that I usually think about publishing. I mean, the literary world in the United States centers around New York City.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been out there for different events. But normally when you deal with your publisher, you're dealing on the phone or you drop by New York City and you visit them at that time. But for me, I can drop by the offices anytime, and I have, and they've invited me over there. So it's a very unusual thing to feel like you have a real face-to-face relationship with your publisher, and they happen to be in Seattle, which is unusual.
Well, it's actually pretty amazing. I mean, Seattle, I feel like we're very, very lucky. Seattle seems to be on, I don't know, it just, when you look around the country at Detroit, and, you know, all of these other places, there's just a lot of communities and cities that are really struggling. And I always like to remind my kids and people they know, this is not the norm in most of America. You know, we really are in an unusual, thriving spot in this country. We have to keep that in mind.
Right. I mean, I think it's especially these days when everyone can choose exactly where they want to live, the fact that we have a vibrant arts community. I mean, the interesting thing about having a global company like Amazon is it also is a bit of a contrast to a very vibrant, very local arts community.
Yes.
Right? You can find readings and art and artists everywhere you go.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from the smallest scale to the largest scale that you can find.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful. It's sort of like a mix from every scale, from small to large.
Yeah. No, we are very lucky. And so let's see. So your first published novel is titled The Adventures of the, I want to say it the Japanese proper. I think it'd be what? Karaoke?
Right.
Okay. So The Adventures of the Karaoke King in more American speak. And this book is big.
It is. It's over 500 pages long, which is pretty astounding to me.
Yeah. And as a first novel, I mean, one of the common pieces of information given out to writers trying to get their first novel published is, you know, 80,000 words and you're good type of thing.
That's right. That's right.
So do you think that Amazon did something really unusual to be publishing the size of a novel?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure, but I agree with you that the common wisdom is that you have a short novel, and especially mm-hmm. first novel, they want 100,000 words or less.
Right.
At the same time, the way this book is structured is meant to be this big sprawling mm-hmm. novel about globalization.
Right.
So that, for that reason, structurally, it needed to be rather large.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say that Amazon Publishing goes for longer novels or shorter novels,
right.
either way. But fortunately, I ran into an editor that was really committed to the vision I had for the novel.
Right. I mean, some like Lord of the Rings, you just really couldn't have pulled off that entire
exactly.
trilogy in 80,000 words.
Exactly. I would agree with that.
Yeah. Some stories just need more. And in particular, so with The Adventures of the Karaoke King, you have, of course, one protagonist that sort of holds it all together, but you actually do this really interesting construct that I want you to tell our listeners about that allows you to bring in five individual point of view characters and actually having them speak in first person.
Right, right.
So explain a little bit about how you did that and what that means for maybe a listener who doesn't quite understand exactly what I'm saying. And then also why you chose that construct.
Sure. Well, Adventures of the Karaoke King is a karaoke grail quest about people who keep on falling just short of their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it's actually its structure and its feeling are patterned after, well, two things. You know, first of all, the model for this book is like Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Mm-hmm.
But since this is a book about globalization, instead of this wide river that the protagonist is traveling along, the main character, Guy Watanabe, is mm-hmm. traveling along this sort of large stream of commerce.
Right.
Right. In terms of the structure of the novel with five different points of view, because it centers around this karaoke, basically Guy is the winner of a local karaoke competition.
Right.
And so it's structured like a night of karaoke in which different people will ascend the stage to take the microphone.
And when they do that in traditional karaoke, you get to choose your own song?
Exactly, exactly. So, and most people will, actually the interesting thing about the main character, Guy Watanabe, is that most people have go-to songs.
Right.
And so they a lot of people like to practice a certain song. They know when they go up there in front of this audience that they're going to sound good.
Mine was La Isla Bonita by Madonna.
That's a great song. That's a great song.
It is.
Well, with Guy, well, that's funny. You're living on a beautiful island. So that's nice that you choose.
Well, this was a long time ago that I did karaoke. Back in the day of Madonna. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, well with Guy, part of his quest is essentially to find his voice. So it's mm-hmm. kind of it's a coming of age story for him. Coming of age story for somebody in their mid-30s, trying to find meaning and purpose in their lives. So
especially unmarried without children.
Well, actually, he's divorced,
right.
where his wife left him,
right.
and without children.
Right.
And just trying to find, you know, what's the significance of his life when he thought he was living it for someone else?
That's a good question.
Right. I agree with that. And so the strange thing about Guy is he wins this title, but he doesn't have a go-to song. He's a person that will just sort of go with whatever he thinks will work for everybody else.
Oh.
Right. And and with the other characters, what they're doing when they come to the fore is they're speaking in the first person. And what you're seeing is Guy's essentially an unreliable narrator. I mean, not in the sense that he's crazy and you can't trust anything he's saying.
Right.
But you start to recognize through the other voices that he's not seeing the whole story.
Right.
That he has a misperception about different people and what's actually happening.
Oh,
and
right,
in that process,
right.
He needs to learn, because these people take the stage and they tell him things that he never dreamed could happen to other people or were in their backgrounds. And I think that's something that is fascinating to me, is that if you actually ever get into a room full of people, you have 30 people, if you actually talk about things that matter, you will find the most astounding things.
Yes.
And just you cannot believe that people have survived through the experiences they've had.
Well, and I think what's so powerful about that construct, and now I'm understanding more about why you would choose it, the incredible sense of vulnerability,
right?
That I instantly feel as you were explaining a little bit more of that backstory there, because for many people, not everyone, but for many of us, one of our fears is that we will think we know something about someone, think we've read them correctly or know what's going on, and be completely wrong.
That's right.
Completely off base.
That's right.
And then to have that exposed,
right,
is, I think, for a lot of people, you just want to cringe.
Right.
And so I bet that in some ways really is what hits your readers, because the book's hard to read.
Right. There's some
It's got painful. I mean, I don't want to make it like, don't read it, because yes, it's intensely awesome to read this book, but this is not a feel-good summer read.
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, and I think that that surprises some people, because it is really meant to be a story in which hopefully you start out and it feels light and enjoyable, because I literally chose the name of the main character, Guy Watanabe, to be just a guy. He's a kid who grew up in Beacon Hill in Seattle. You know, he's just there trying to figure things out.
Right.
And then it kind of descends into hell. You know, and he just runs across people, and he is sort of, he gets involved with so many things that force him to see people in a new way. And so that's really, it's really about waking up. I mean, if I were to follow any kind of story arc,
right?
If you talk about archetypical kinds of stories,
right,
this is actually kind of like a Buddhist awakening story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with the story of the Buddha, the idea is that everybody tried to shield the young prince from the world, from the pain. They would hide the sick away. They would hide people who were aging. And then when he finally got to go outside and he discovered there was so much pain, he needed to find out the reasons for that pain.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to leave his family and all of his comfort. So similarly, in this story, Guy is having his eyes opened, and he has to start making some choices. Once you see these things, can you really unsee them? And I think in present day society, the weird thing is we have all the information in front of us. We know every atrocity that happens frequently within minutes of it happening.
Right.
And at the same time, we need to protect ourselves and our capacity to feel, especially to feel pain without and not feel powerless. And so frequently we hear it and we say, I've got to not think about that too much, because I've got to get through the day. I've got to, you know, get my kids to school. I've got to make a meal.
Right. One of my major focuses in my life is to be very careful about what I take in.
Right.
And the small portion of that has to do with a little bit of self-preservation. Like, I'm not going to watch a slasher flick, you know, and see really gross, disgusting things, because I'm very visual. So an image that goes into my head usually sticks for a really long time.
Right.
But also, as that you know, full-time mom, farmer, you know, I'm the go-to person for the family on a lot of issues, and a person who has goals and she needs to put her energy into achieving them.
Yes.
If I take in information about something that is deeply disturbing and that I would like to see that altered, and
right,
I do not have either the time or the capability to do anything about it,
right,
then that's just, it's not useless. In a way, I don't know even how to explain this. It's going to probably sound bad, but there is no point in me understanding, knowing about 10 horrible things that are happening in 10 other countries on the other side, right, of the planet if I do not have an intention or an ability to do something about it. All I've done is slow myself down, depress myself, you know.
Sure, absolutely.
And so, like, there's people I know on Facebook,
right,
and, you know, they'll send out things that are just really, really, really intense. And
right,
I'm like, you know, I can't do something about that. So it's right, not that I don't want to be aware. It's that I want to be aware about those things that I have the ability to impact.
Well, I mean, I think that's
so
the truth of it.
So it's weird how people have to make that.
Well, that's actually, I think, a completely empathetic response, right? I mean, when we feel the pain of others,
right,
that puts us in a position of almost responsibility. Like,
absolutely,
what are we going to do with that pain? And
yes,
so with so much pain in the world,
right,
you know, how can we find that place to help alleviate that pain in a way that's immediate,
mm-hmm,
and in a way that's not this feeling of, I can't take it anymore, I just want to hide away and have nothing to do with anybody else.
Right. You don't want to go from denial to despair.
Correct.
You want to stop in the middle and take action.
Correct.
But to be truly effective,
correct,
you need to usually go deep.
Well, you know, I mean, it's fascinating.
You know?
The interesting thing is, I mean, I think there's a great quote by Mae Sarton, and she said that it takes heroic efforts to be a perfectly decent human being.
Right.
And I think that's very true. And I think that what you're
right,
doing here on Voice of Vashon is if you work incredibly locally,
mm-hmm,
and if you can connect with the people around you, you can do good work where you can see tangible results. That
yeah,
is bringing this positive force into the world. And it's very easy. I mean, the weird thing about this book about globalization is that
right,
it's about a kind of despair and a helplessness that descends on you when you feel like you are just this piece of flotsam in this enormous sea of commerce and there nothing you do will ever have any impact.
Right.
But then you still want to have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and perhaps we can, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which we can is to connect with exactly who you're with now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to find those places, those ways in which you can start doing more good than harm.
Right, which is a bit why, you know, the world went to globalization as a natural pendulum swing. And we started to realize, oh, okay, there's these benefits maybe, but there's these problems too. And
right,
now as we have left the more local traditions
that's
of
right,
the past, we look back and go, oh, right, that was really good, actually. And so the pendulum swings back because we're
right,
trying to find more of a middle ground instead
right,
of one extreme or the other, of course. So,
right,
yeah.
Well, I keep on wondering, I mean, with globalization, especially the exchange of information, there used to be in the past where, I mean, the present too, but
right,
with cultural commodities, we used to be able to produce things in America, for example, films
right,
or music, and just with our might sort of push it out to the rest of the world to where folks on other parts of the world are going to try to mimic that. And a lot of the traditional arts will wither. Like, for example, I lived for 2 years in Thailand.
Right.
1 year I was an exchange student when I was going to college. And 1 year I was a Fulbright scholar
mm-hmm,
doing anthropological research. But when you go there, there's incredible local arts. Like there's something called in northern Thailand called a sung. And it is like improvisational poetry set to music. And it's been done for many, many generations. And you
mm-hmm,
get these people who are speaking northern dialect. So it's not the central Thai dialect, who will basically have to make up rhymes with each other as music is playing right on the spot.
Right, right. In their form of improv.
In their form of improv. Beautiful and lots of wordplay.
Uh-huh.
Thai is it's a tonal language. It's also naturally a very musical language because it has long vowels and short vowels.
What's the name of the language?
Oh, it's called, it's Kamung, but it's Northern Thai dialect. of it's okay. It's closer to being Lao than it is to being Thai. So the Northern Thai folks will understand Lao folks more easily than they would Central Thai
folks. It's sort of like Italians will understand Spanish a little bit easier than maybe French.
Right. So,
yeah.
Right. Right. Except they're a little bit closer. Lao and Northern Thai are really, really close.
So you speak which dialect fluently?
I speak Central Thai, which is the main book language.
Is it also a tonal language?
It is a tonal language.
Does that mean by is English a tonal language?
English is considered not a tonal language. English uses tones only for inflection. To ask a question, something goes up. Like, hello, is that a glass?
See.
So we actually do use tones, but not in the same way. Like Chinese is a tonal language. Thai is a tonal language. It means that, for example, if you say it in a different tone, it's a different word. For example, if you say ma, that means dog. If you say ma, that means horse, right? And, you know, one is sort of a dipping tone, goes ma, and one is a high tone, which is ma.
Interesting.
Right? But then in Thai, you also add the additional layer of long vowels and short vowels. So, for example, if you say cow, that would mean to enter. If you say cow, that would mean rice. So the only difference is how long you're sustaining the vowel.
That's sort of like who are you or who.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Who or who.
So I'm saying who is a short vowel, right, and who is a long vowel. Means different things. It happens to also be spelled differently.
Right.
But when it comes to the sound of it, it's the same word, just with a different vowel length.
Right, right.
Oh, wow, exactly. That's fascinating.
Exactly. And so it makes it a naturally musical language and naturally poetic language.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of rhymes. They've also gotten more letters in the alphabet than English does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm forgetting the number. I think even the 46, 47 letters. But they have this wonderful traditional art form that's really difficult. I mean, it is hard.
Improv is hard.
Improv
general,
is just difficult, especially, you know, artfully set to music.
And then poetry. Oh my gosh.
Exactly. And the poetry, it's crazy. But then it's basically a dying art, if it's not dead already, that because instead they roll in a big screen and a projector with a generator, and they at the temple, and they'll project a Chinese ghost story against the wall. And so then young people will want to watch that because there's lots of blood, there's lots of crazy things happening, and will neglect this incredibly beautiful, very subtle art. And I think, you know, that's certainly the past of the way in which, commerce and art and technology have sort of paved over different traditions.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about
the
future.
You see it right now. I mean, like, I've been talking to my kids recently because I had this epiphany,
right?
I think about maybe 3 weeks ago. Might have been when I was on vacation with my son. And it occurred to me that when I was a child, not only did the television, you know, go bing, you know, at like 11 o'clock at night, you know, meh, you know, there's just nothing there but that weird little screen, right? Until the next morning at 6. But that was it. Like, there were no computer games. I mean, there was just none of that. And so all of the children, there were all these games that we knew. And now my dad's generation, it was marbles and jacks and, you know, cowboys and Indians, actually. I was raised by the hippies who didn't want me to play cowboys and Indians. But it was, you know, Red Rover, or there were so many forms of tag.
Right.
Freeze tag and, you know, hide and go seek tag and all these different forms and all these different games. And then I realized my kids don't even know about those games.
Right.
It's not in their head.
That's very true.
It's not. It's like an entire generation of knowledge about how to play outside with other children has gone poof. You know, they talk about when languages are lost because the elders die and the younger people aren't learning the languages. Well, we're learning. You know, I mean, all those games little kids would play with their hands, the girls would slap, 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 da, da, da. I don't see kids doing this stuff anymore, but they sure are nifty with the little computer gadgets and this, you know, and their little laptops and their iPhones and all that stuff. And it's suddenly interesting to realize I am one of those people looking back and seeing a generation's worth of knowledge slipping away through disuse.
That's right. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, there are so many things that are shifting because of technology or lifestyle. Like, I think these days folks are not accustomed to being alone. very frequently, because right. we can have a phone that can either contact other people through Twitter, through Facebook, or have some form of communication or amusement in front of us at all times. I mean, people, even in an airport, are rarely sitting there looking around or looking out the window.
Right.
And I think that...
cars. Do you remember as a kid, the telephone lines?
That's right.
How they dip
that's right.
and rise and dip. And rise, and there's this rhythm to them.
Right, and it's changed the nature of consciousness, right? I don't think we're accustomed to being alone in our own heads
very frequently.
At all times, we have some form of something coming into us from elsewhere.
Right.
And at the same time, for the future, what I'm curious about, and I don't know the answer to this, is that the homogenization of culture, because we've spread things and just sort of paved over these things with the more powerful images, whether
Starbucks is everywhere.
Exactly. Whether it's items or it's culture or if it's movies or music. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if we get incredibly local, because you're talking about the pendulum switch.
Mm-hmm.
If we work local and really distinctly in this place that we're in right now and that has a global reach, can we refertilize? You know, can we create greater diversity instead of making it less diverse?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure. I mean, there are certain images or certain things like a smartphone that are just so powerful and so alluring. And, you know, maybe it's too much for our consciousness to handle.
Right.
But maybe we can go the other direction. So it's an open question, I think.
I have a series of, I call it flash fiction, although recently someone suggested it probably would be perceived more as a long story that's being told in snippets.
Right.
Whereas flash fiction oftentimes is intended to stand entirely 100% absolutely and completely alone forever. But in it, I'm attempting to take this jump forward on a very local level. It's about Vashon after the change.
Right.
And Vashon becomes completely cut off from the rest of the world. And it's what happens next. And it covers about 2.5 to 3 years of how these people respond to absolute, utter, and complete isolation from the rest of the globe.
Right.
And what does that look like?
Right.
Right? Whether it's global warming or any issue we're talking about, our reliance upon fossil fuels, which are a finite source of energy, I'm attempting to bring my readers along to face that sudden change.
Right.
And while I've created it in a fantastical sort of mode, we look back over 1,000 years, you can see almost every, like a million different ways of human living over that 1,000 years. What possible reason would we have to believe the American lifestyle is non-negotiable?
Oh,
I'm like, no, the American lifestyle is guaranteed to die.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing lasts forever. Everything changes. The only constant is change.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something amazing is going to be. And then 1,000 years later, something else amazing is going to be. And I mean, this world is just so rich.
That's so true. That's so true. I mean, that's the interesting thing, is just always recognizing that we're both the agents of change as well as in the middle of change. I mean, sometimes we can get very nostalgic for the past or be very concerned about the future. But then here we are, creating that future in every decision, which is fascinating, because you know, and whether you take that and want to shy away from it, it has a lot to do with whether or not you feel like a real investment into what's here and now.
Well, and even a person who desires responsibility, if they don't feel capable of affecting positive change around an issue, that sense of disempowerment is really intense. And so
right.
and not everyone can make the change they necessarily want to make, but you can be a part of it.
Right. Right.
So for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on 101.9 FM. My name is March Twisdale, and my guest author this month is Harold Taw, author of The Adventures of the Karaoke King. However, in addition to this novel, which we've been discussing, you have a second novel that sort of the publishers are waiting for, and they are eager for that. But in the interim, you danced a little bit sideways into a completely sort of different realm of artistic work. Why don't you tell us about what you are doing right now.
Right.
And let us know.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I think I entered into the realm of writing for musical theater as a way of myself sort of trying to beat back a sense of helplessness. Mm. And let me try to explain that. Is after I'd finished my novel and had it published, my children had just turned 2 years old.
And you have twins.
I have twins. Mm-hmm. They're now, they've just turned six. But the publication of the novel in 2011, they just turned two. Mm-hmm. Of course, caring for two-year-old twins takes a lot of time and energy. At the same time, I was writing my second novel, which I did a lot of research for and is dealing with some pretty bleak subject matter, dealing mm-hmm. with development in the 1970s, an adolescent girl moving from the village to the city during a very difficult time in political history.
In which
history.
Country?
In Southeast Asia. It's my sort of
roughly.
Imaginary
yeah.
Southeast Asia. But during this push and pull of the Cold War and a lot of choices being made around development.
Right.
It was, you know, and so sitting down with my research and dealing with subject matter that was sometimes really bleak and then also sort of taking that bleakness and bringing it out to my kids was making me feel like I wasn't really doing quite the right thing mm-hmm. on both sides, because I was feeling like I was just walking this endless bleak road. And then I was walking out and bringing that sort of bleakness to my children. So
right.
The interesting thing is they got really interested in musical theater and would want at the age of two and want to listen to the musical Les Miserables.
Talk about bleak.
Which is bleak. But they loved it. And they would ask for the time, you know, the song.
So it rubbed off yeah. and got positive.
Exactly. Rubbed off, got positive. They would sing, you know, just really happily. They'd want to hear the song where Cosette's daddy was dying and say, oh, we want the one where he's dying. But they loved it. They loved that. They right. could sing One Day More. They knew the every part of One Day More. And because of the fact that if you have children, you know that they will listen to things over and over
oh,
and over
yeah.
again. So at the same time, I'd been attending musical theater for years and been interested in musical theater, but never felt like I truly understood how you approached it, how you mm-hmm. create stories using that medium. Mm-hmm. And so about the same time, a Seattle rock band by the name of Poland approached me and asked if I might help them to develop their music into a stage musical.
Oh.
And so through that, we started playing around with story ideas, experimenting. It was a wonderful experience. And from there, that's how I ended up applying to and being accepted to a program with the Fifth Avenue Theater in
right.
Seattle to join their Seattle Writers Group, which is basically it's a new initiative at the Fifth Avenue Theater. They've mm-hmm. been around for 2 years. They have a new works program, and they're trying to support development of new works from the very beginning, from idea all the way up to getting to the stage. In terms of their local writers initiative, they're supporting
right.
three teams through that process. And so I was paired up with a wonderful composer lyricist by the name of Chris Jeffries, who won mm-hmm. The very first Stranger Genius Award in theater arts. He's just an amazing, amazing composer lyricist. He's done everything in musical theater.
I love that. I think once a year they come out with the genius.
That's right.
Oh,
that's right.
It's so wonderful to read that issue and just be reminded that there are reasons to hope, that there are some great people doing great things in the world, because that
right.
never makes it into the mainstream media.
That's right. I mean, you get blown away by the artists that are in a community that just do the most astounding work. You
yeah.
know, and Chris is one of them. I mean, I've listened to some of his songs that he wrote for other shows that have just, well, including our show, but they've just made me cry. He's just incredible. So I've had a wonderful experience. It's been great working with the Fifth Avenue Theater and getting the opportunity to have folks there come in, listen to our work, talk about our work, try to improve our work.
Mm-hmm.
They are able to bring in performers that can come sing through our work, and we get a real sense for whether what's working and what's not
right
at the early stage. And I think for theater, and this is what I'm learning
so
as a writer.
It's major mentoring.
And major mentor. Well, we meet every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful dramaturg who's working with us by the name of Albert Evans, who's working with mm-hmm. us to develop our adaptation of Jane Austen's final novel, which is Persuasion, that we're developing as a two-act musical.
And so just so I'm just so we're clear.
Yep.
If you take Jane Austen's final novel Persuasion and you adapt it
yes.
into a play,
yes.
how rigorously are you expected to stick to the storyline and the presumed goals that Jane Austen had for that work, and how much artistic license do you have?
Well, you know, the answer to that, well, with Jane Austen, because her work is now 200 years old,
mm-hmm.
It's in the public domain, then that has to do with where the creative artists who are adapting her work, where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have to do, in terms of the input from the Fifth Avenue Theater, they're trying to honor wherever the creative artists want to go with something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they're looking for primarily is dramatic impact. You know, what is it really having the impact that we're seeking to have it make?
Mm-hmm.
But it's true that if you're adapting another work that you secure rights for, so if you secure the rights for a contemporary novel,
right.
And then you would have to figure out exactly how much liberties can you take with a story. In terms
right.
of us and with Jane Austen's novel Persuasion, I think that I would say musical theater is a completely different medium, and
mm-hmm.
it expresses itself in a very different way from prose.
Yeah.
And so what you want to do, like at least what we would like to do, is really utilize the strengths of each medium and really bring not what I think would be – I think an error would be to make it almost like reading the book with an orchestra playing in the background.
Right.
Yeah. Or to flatten it. Or if you took it and were saying, well, I just want to make a commercial musical that will be super popular, so we're going to turn it into some form of light romantic comedy.
It's basically a movie on a stage.
A movie on a stage.
And is what you're not looking to do.
Not looking to do that. I mean, we
right.
really want to just tell it through the musical medium. Make
mm-hmm.
the, you know, what really matters, what are the strengths of the musical medium that are kinds of communication that can't happen in any other form.
Right, of course.
Right.
Yeah, because you just don't have the same guitar sounds when you crack open the book.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Okay. Well, we talked about Persuasion, I'm pretty sure, a while ago, and I don't want to delve into that, but it's so easy to take a novel that was written in the past, especially some of her work, and then you apply historical context
mm-hmm.
to it,
mm-hmm.
and you go, oh, you know, she was writing this from a very specific lens, though Jane Austen does poke fun at the wealthy elite in some ways. There still is a sort of a higher class worship going on.
There can be. There certainly can be. I mean, I think that, you know, Jane
but
Austen.
Strands, you can pull
oh, absolutely.
Other historical strands
absolutely.
Out of it that are really awesome.
Oh, I agree. I mean, and I Jane Austen is, you know, one of my favorite novelists of all
yes.
time. Just as a writer. Just so amazing in terms of craft, in terms of characterizations, in terms of there are minor characters.
You They'll need. Have a reason for being there.
Exactly. You know, I mean,
yeah.
she's just like if when you start trying to adapt something by Jane Austen, it's fascinating because you realize if you try to pull one strand, like things start to fall apart.
Right.
Because she really was very careful with her construction. And I think Persuasion is interesting because I agree with you. There are aspects of different novels. People are drawn to her different novels for different reasons.
Right.
And there are aspects that, you know, to many sensibilities can be very troubling. I mean, I think that one of my favorite authors is Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
And his opinion of Jane Austen was, you know, any library is a good library that doesn't have Jane Austen in it.
Oh,
which is fascinating because I actually see a lot of similarity in their writing.
Well, yeah, because they're both doing social commentary.
Exactly. Exactly. And they both had a very rigorous eye for the authentic
mm-hmm.
and no patience for lack of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating that he would have that view of someone who's a little bit of a kindred spirit.
Which is why they've lasted, though.
Which is why they've lasted. I agree. And I think, you know, Persuasion for me as her final novel is really her swan song. It's really the most autobiographical piece. So it's really the darkest of all of her novels. And I think for that reason, it was really rich for musical adaptation because there's so many shades and
yeah.
hues that you can bring out through music, through musical storytelling that are, it's very difficult.
Like you said, with the tonal language.
Exactly.
You can strum the right note and get an audience just to burst into tears or to burst into laughter.
That's right.
In a way that no matter how, you know, the words wouldn't do it alone.
That's right. I mean, and it's a very complex novel. It's very, I mean, I think Virginia Woolf said that Persuasion indicated where her work would have gone had she lived longer.
She died at 42 or 40?
I think it was 40. Yeah, I believe that was right.
What a loss.
A huge loss. Huge loss. And so I think that the dark shades, it really helps us in terms of the more complexity there is, the more that it seems inexpressible in any other form. That's what we want to bring into the musical. We want to use the music to tell those stories that can't be told in a very literal way.
Unfortunately, the first premiere show of this is going to be limited, I believe, to community.
Within the industry, right.
There's no open ticket sales at this point.
That's correct. I mean, in terms of musicals, usually it's a long process of development. And then when the Fifth Avenue decided they're going to support musicals right from the beginning all the way to the end, usually most musicals it takes about 5 years to go from page to stage. So we're at the early end. And what we need to do is what they're going to be presenting during their inaugural Next Fest festival during the summertime is present all the new works that they're supporting. And this will be a staged reading, which is the first step along the way. They'll be singing. There'll be the whole script.
Right.
There'll be, the full week of rehearsals. But it's meant to be for sort of industry folks.
And feedback
because it's still developmental.
Right.
And try to sort of get both feedback, develop it more, and get some interest from folks that may want to take this to the next step.
Do you know about, I believe it's called Lizard Boy?
I have heard of Lizard Boy, yeah.
Okay, so I saw it. So Fantastic. What I'm talking about right now, is that Intiment Theater?
Was that Seattle Rep?
Seattle Rep, that's it. Okay, yes. And, I just about wanted to, die with joy.
Fantastic.
There's three main people in it, and this is what's interesting. Of course, it's musical theater. It's exactly what you're doing.
Right.
It's new works.
Right.
It's brand new. The entire thing's new. I mean, there's not even a book to base it upon. And what was amazing to me, you find out at the end, is that the three people who are in it, who never leave the stage, they were on the stage every minute of the entire play. All three of them were essentially the creators. The one gentleman was the one that had the idea, and then he pulled the other two in to workshop it with him.
Great.
And it's his first play.
Fantastic.
He's a new playwright. And I mean, and they wrote the music.
Right.
I'm just my jaw is dropping over and over again at all the various areas of talent and skill that these three people had to pull off this fabulous play. And then you're talking about what you're doing, and immediately I started realizing, it's not just I'm going to go see the Nutcracker, or, it's not just I'm going to go see something Oklahoma or something Les Mis or something that's been produced a million times.
Right.
This is so heartening.
Well, I mean, I've got to say.
New works.
Oh, yes.
I'm so Definitely. Grateful.
Well, it's fascinating for me because coming from a background of prose and the writing community, entering the theater community, I am blown away by the level of talent and the theater artists here in the city. I mean, I think we have to have one of the finest theater communities in the nation. I mean, and people really, they just go for it. You know, they do some amazing work and they pull people together any way they can and they just do it.
Yeah. And it's like you just want to get every single child out there and bring them to a play and every grandparent.
Oh, I wish that would happen. I mean, there's something very magical about seeing art created only for that moment. It will never be the same on a different night. And it's interesting because I know I have friends who despise theater. They want to go just to movies. The idea of going to theater bores them, right? Because it's this whole idea, well, you know what, it's going to be hard, it's going to be too intellectual, or it's going to be this or that. But it's astounding. And especially, I mean, if you hear someone sing live they are an amazing singer, you literally feel goosebumps going up and down your arm.
That only happens live.
That's
I mean, I've been in a bunch of theater for the last 4 to 5 years in the island. We sort of got involved and I've been in plays. My kids have been in plays.
Right.
And it's true. Almost every time at some point you're sitting there and goosebumps erupt and the little shiver goes up your back.
Right.
That just doesn't happen. I mean, I saw Into the Woods, the movie.
Right.
Meryl Streep did a beautiful job of singing. Many of the women did a fabulous job singing and the guys. But I never had my hair lifted.
Right. Right.
I imagine it must be literally there are vibrations of sound moving through
absolutely
the space and
absolutely
the body responds. And it's fabulous.
I agree. Well, you know, the funnest thing for me was going into the rehearsal space at the Fifth Avenue Theater and doing that regularly and seeing people performing, dancing. You know, it's normal now to walk in the rehearsal space and they're doing they're rehearsing for an upcoming show and you see people leaping through the air or holding swords and singing and I was like, wow, this is a cool thing to be part of this.
You know? Running from one changing room to the next half naked. You know, what I found hilarious when we were in Rocky Horror Show. So I was in that.
Right.
It was a blast. It was so much fun. But my kids, I brought them along, even though you had to be 18 or older to be in the show. My husband works full time. It's a summer show. I'm rehearsing in the middle of the day. And I said to my kids, look, there's these awesome college guys who are playing, you know, Rocky and whatnot. And come hang out. They would sit in the back and play magic. So here you've got the young actors who would show up with their boxes of magic cards, and my kids would show up, and they'd all be hanging out in the corner, you know, and then they'd all get up and go put on makeup and come back and keep playing magic, which is a card game.
Right.
And the funniest thing is that you'll know what I'm talking about here. So there's this, when someone has a mic, it's attached to a little square box that has the battery and everything, and that's usually attached to your waist or something, and that's what allows the wireless mic to function. Well, you can't get those things wet. And so there's condoms everywhere because the best thing to cover those things with are condoms. And so you've got all these people walking around ripping open condoms and squeezing condoms over these little black packs. And then they attach it to their back and they walk off. And then people come in and they'd be like, oh, did your condom break again? They're like, yes, I need another one.
You know? That is so
funny.
And
here's my kids who are, you know, I don't know, they were whatever age they were. And I thought, this is great exposure for my sons to the normalcy of condoms. So it sounds like you did that thing you needed to do. You went from sort of a deep, intense novel. You said, I got my twins here. I want to go have fun.
I wanted to do something more collaborative.
Right.
And still remain, you know, incredibly creative.
Right.
And this is that. I mean, I think that, I mean, musical theater, anyone who's developed a musical theater knows it is hard. It is hard to develop a really good, solid show. Because this is what I found. The funny thing about prose, and which I love about prose, is that, you know, you write, you create your entire world.
Right.
And then when it's done, that's its presentation form. That's the way it looks. And if you've made any mistakes, you know, there it is on the page. You've just got to figure the reader is going to either take it
forgive you
or take it in, and that's the end product.
Yeah.
But a musical is fascinating in stage, but a musical especially takes place in real time. And so the weirdest thing is when it does not work, it is excruciating, right? Because you're stuck there. You can literally make 3 minutes of time seem like 3 hours.
Of miserable time.
Of miserable time. Yes. You know, you feel like your life is flashing in front of your eyes. You're sweating. You're like, how can I get out of here?
And he's still not remembering his line.
Exactly. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. But I love.
Someone throw the rubber chicken.
Well, that's the thing. And you know, the funny thing is you write something down on a page and you go, this is fantastic. I love it. And then somebody speaks it. You go, oh, that was horrible. Horrible. What was I thinking? What was going on?
We need to recast this.
Oh, yeah,
know,
that's true.
You never know. And imagine once you put it out there. So you put a book out there. Even if you put an audio book out there, you get to choose who the person is. They do the final draft. It gets all, you know, once again, it's locked in.
Right.
Locked down, right? You write a play, and then they decide for some reason that they're going to go ahead and do it again.
That's right.
And, you know, someone else is going to direct it. Like, would a playwright ever want to go see their play again, performed and directed and, you know, shot by someone else, or would they just not be able to handle it?
Right. I mean, I wonder. I mean, it's fascinating to me. I mean, I love the fact that it's so collaborative that every person brings something different.
Right.
And you have to, it's kind of like you have to be okay with that. You've got to say, okay.
You have to be able to let go.
That's right.
And let it be a living creature.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so in the time we have left, I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit sort of funny here.
Sure.
I think three things. First, you've got a piece that you're going to read. Also, I often talk about the inciting incident, that moment in their life, that event that as a result of, they suddenly sit down, grab a pad of paper and a pen and start writing something that turns out to be a 400-page novel. And then what I would also like you to do is address the ending of the novel.
I see.
So there's why did you write it? And then as we were talking about earlier, there are, in a way, two Americas.
Right. That sounds great if we have time.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Well, I mean, in terms of the inciting incident, I mean, it's important to know with Adventures of the Karaoke King, it's definitely a novel, a story about voice.
Right.
In terms of the beginning, it started to come out of a late night of singing karaoke at Busch Gardens.
Uh-huh.
In the International District. Uh-huh. And I was there with my brother-in-law, and we were sitting there drinking and singing. Mm-hmm. And there was this one person, this one guy, who was all alone at a table mm-hmm. with just a line of shots in front of him.
Oh.
Just kind of drinking himself into oblivion. And at the same time, every once in a while, his song would come up. And he'd ascend the stage, and he'd sing the most heartbreaking song. He would sing every song about heartbreak and loss that you could possibly think of.
Oh,
and it was so sad. And then he'd go back, and he'd sit down, and he'd drink alone again, and then keep on doing it. And I couldn't – it just sort of stuck in my mind. I was just thinking, right. You know, what happened to this guy? How did he get here? Where was he before? How did he get here? Right. Where is he going to go?
Right.
And so that was the start of the novel. With the end of the novel, there's all sorts of things, but they're all leading to this one return to the United States. And mm-hmm. what happens to Guy is he ends up eventually because of he's got an evil nemesis who's trying to dominate the worldwide karaoke market.
Okay.
Right? So eventually
this is the absurd.
This is the
element.
Absurd. Well, this is the absurdity of the novel is it's trying to make the absurd, completely normal. So
right.
this person is trying to dominate the karaoke market,
right?
And try to show the absurdity of what we believe to be normal,
mm-hmm.
and that's where people like all of a sudden said, "I don't really believe this aspect." And what this aspect was that in the end, Guy ends up voiceless and inside of the Northwest Detention Center mm-hmm. in Tacoma, which is the federal detention center for people who are perhaps undocumented and are going to be deported. And so he winds up there unable to speak and unable to convince anybody at all that he is actually an American citizen.
Right.
And when the way in which people reacted to that was some people said that's just not believable because our government would not wind up detaining a U.S. citizen for months. I think I had him detained for about 5 to 6 months.
Our government couldn't make a mistake like that. In
right.
other words.
Right. Well, yeah. Right. That, and you know, the amazing thing is, there are people who say that's just unbelievable. We are better than that. We don't make those kinds of mistakes. You know, how could somebody possibly say they're American citizen or try? He's trying to gesture and write, and they're just not taking any of it.
Right.
And the weird thing is, of course, that normal that is clearly absurd was based on an actual incident that happened in the Northwest Detention Center
mm-hmm.
in which an American citizen, an Army veteran, was detained for 7 months, which was actually longer than the period that I depicted mm-hmm. in the book. And he could actually speak.
Right.
And he could actually say, no, I am an American citizen. You
I
can check these documents.
War,
I fought in this war. You know, call my, you know,
mom
former officer, you know,
right.
call my family. And they just said, we don't believe you. You would say anything to get out of here. Mm-hmm. This happened in, I believe, in 2006. I mean, the government ended up apologizing to him. He settled for $400,000 because they simply would not even talk to anyone he told them to talk to.
Right.
Right. So this is, I mean, and this is also a result of what I'm trying to get at is that these are private prisons. There is incredible
right.
push. This is a $1.7 billion industry.
Oh yeah.
Over a single year, it's about $1.7 billion that we will spend on immigrant detention.
Yeah.
They lobby. I think they spent over $20 million. Private prisons did
right.
lobbying for their own interests to try to put more immigrants mm-hmm. In detention. So
right.
at $122 a night. Right, because
like really expensive hotel.
Exactly,
this with is no like, amenities. It doesn't
this
cost
is like,
anything to run.
And they go to these. Yeah. They go to certain communities and they say this is a job creation
right.
issue. We can help create jobs. And look, these immigrants, they aren't even dangerous, and we can imprison them and they're not going to get out and harm anybody, which is, you know, the most bizarre thing in the entire world.
We think tobacco makers were bad,
right? I mean, and it's horrible. It's horrible. And so there's a great book that I used in research called American Gulag by right. Mark Dow. It seems that the only things that were doubted in my novel were the things that were absolutely true,
most accurate,
the most accurate.
Reality is stranger than fiction.
That's right. How can we be that bad? But the thing is, we've got to figure out, how do good people do bad things?
Right.
Right? I mean, I don't think, I frankly just don't think people were trying to deny Mr. Castillo, who was detained for 7 months, his rights. Mm-hmm. But they were coming through a certain lens,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were seeing, like, these people lie.
Right.
They cannot be trusted. Therefore,
and we
he
have
must
limited
be
resources.
Exactly.
And so
we can't pick up a phone and call anyone he mentions, for
right.
example. Like,
it's
you get
like,
trapped into a system.
It's weird.
And a mode of thought.
Yeah.
And you just proceed. I mean, with Mr. Castillo, my understanding is, I think he had his military ID in the trunk of his car. And so it wouldn't even, not only would they not call, they wouldn't check the trunk of his car.
They like had impounded his car.
Yeah, I mean, so
and they didn't even search it.
That's my understanding.
Oh,
that's my understanding,
goodness.
Which is, you know, I mean, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
America.
The other
once
America.
You're in that detention center, you're in the other America.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Well, maybe on that note, we should end.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
So let's see here. Yes, for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on 101.9 FM. This is Voice of Eshon, and my name is March Twisdale. My guest author this month is Harold Taw. That's T-A-W. You can learn more about him at haroldtaw.com. Harold is the author of The Adventures of the Karaoke King. And also, what is the actual title of your play in work? I mean, you're essentially a play right now.
Correct. So we're adapting Jane Austen's Persuasion.
And there's no working title. It'll just be Persuasion.
It will be Persuasion.
Okay,
yes.
Got it. Great. And that will probably come available to the public in a couple of years as you get towards the end of that 5-year process.
We're hoping, definitely.
Super exciting.
Oh, so I did want to mention one more thing.
Oh, and you didn't do your reading.
Oh, that's all right. I mean, I don't think we have to go into the reading.
Okay.
But I did want to mention that I'm co-curating literary series in West Seattle. It's called Words West.
Yes.
Literary series that I'm co-curating with writers Susan Rich and mm-hmm. Katie E. Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
And we began in September 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And we're monthly on the third Wednesday of every month at C&P Coffee at 7 p.m.
Great coffee shop. For everyone who loves Cafe Luna or Minglement on this island, you will love C&P. And they have a tea. They have a tea there. I need to find out the name of their tea. Oh, my gosh. It's herbally. Oh, it's just heaven. Try the tea.
And it's a wonderful place. I mean, it's an incredible community center. It's got a pea patch in the back, a poetry pole in the back. Just the perfect place. It's an old...
Every chair is different. Looks like it came out of
exactly,
an antique building.
Exactly. And it's an old 20th, early 20th century house, about 1907, 1908. It used to be a former lodge.
You can also just walk across the ferry, hop on the sea line, and get off right in front of C&P Cafe and have an exemplary experience right here in West Seattle.
I agree. I mean, it's been a fantastic series. You can also find our YouTube video and podcast audio.
Oh, cool.
On our website, wordswestliterary.com.
Words with an S.
Yes, wordswestliterary.com. Correct.
Beautiful. Harold, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you for having me, March.
Yay.